You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show. Today with special guest host, Zane Velji.
Hey, what's going on, Canada? Happy Thursday. Oh, I hope you're doing well. Hope you're doing well wherever you are in this fine, fabulous country. I'm coming to you from beautiful Calgary, Alberta. I peek over just looking at the skies right now. Finally, a bit of clarity. Finally, air quality that's getting better. I know many of our listeners in the West Coast and still some in Ontario struggling with poor air quality, wildfires, traveling, smoke across the country. Wishing everyone safety in that regard and hope that everyone is finding shelter, doing well, and keeping well. Great show for you today, by the way. Thankfully, if you were tired, if you were exhausted, if you were done with my rants on Jeff Bezos, by the way, if you missed them, huge vanity project, Jeff Bezos floating in space. I'm done with it. I'm not going to do it anymore. I have made a vow to producer Hannah, to you, the audience, that I will not talk about Jeff Bezos anymore and how I find just all of it ridiculous. But anyways, I wanted to make one quick point before I move on from it. So this is my exception to said rule that I've just put in place. But a fascinating study from Media Matters, an organization that tracks media coverage across the United States. In 2020, the coverage for climate, you know that issue that's made its way to number one or number two? You know that issue that is a catalyzer of the smoke and the air quality that I just mentioned about? Well, in 2020, climate coverage on U.S. morning shows was about 267 minutes across the whole year. Jeff Bezos, on July 20th alone, had 212 minutes of coverage for what he was up to. Yeah, too much. And I'm going to put an end to it right there and then. I'm done with it. But a great show for you today. I'm going to talk to you about follow a bouncing ball in the most bizarre story in Canadian politics. I'm actually ready to declare that, by the way. I'm ready to declare, and actually I'm going to go one step further, that the story about the Green Party and its leader is maybe the most bizarre story of the last half decade I have seen in Canadian politics. It has a bit of everything, and we're going to find out a bit more about where that story is landed and where it goes from here. I also want to talk about cancel culture. Oh, yes, why not? But this time, cancel culture meets another target in our culture. That's the Olympic Games. Find out how, in terms of how cancel culture and the Olympics have now overlapped in the societal Venn diagram. And then I want to talk about, I go from bizarre story to cancel culture, and then you'll also hear on the show today a story that just combines everything that is holy and gracious about neighborhood living. It has municipal zoning, chef's kiss. It has NIMBYism, why not? And it has a monstrosity of a home. This story is so bizarre, and I can't wait to get into it with you later on in the show. I mean, it just, I could go on for the full 2 hours on it. I really could. Knowing just the three lines that I do about it, I think we could do full 2 hours together. But we will discuss that story that I think you will find shocking, weird, beautiful, wonderful, and encapsulating a particular type of culture that we have in this particular country. Okay, let me start here, though. And let me get a little bit more serious with the tone as well, because as much as I'm excited for some aspects of the show, I want to now be candid with you for a second. I want to be candid with you about, you know, as you've gotten to know me over the course of the last couple of days, and as I have the privilege to sit here with you next week as well, filling in for the great Evan Solomon. One of the things that over the last year that has been increasingly core to some of the things I care about, or some of the value, or has been emblematic of some of the values that I have, is housing. I have gotten involved in housing advocacy, affordable housing advocacy, working with some tremendous organizations around homelessness, around housing, around ending homelessness. In fact, you know, advocating for it through a platform called Vote Housing, nonpartisan, et cetera. And the reason I tell you that is, A, the disclosure, so you know that this is something close to my heart and what I value and what I deeply care for. But secondly, is to talk to you about a development yesterday that many may have seen or frankly heard in Toronto, where yesterday, 26 people were arrested at Toronto's Lamport Stadium Park as the city and police forcibly evicted those living in an encampment. Here's what it sounded like. And you, when you see it, it's so much more, but you'll get it just from the sounds. Because here's what it sounded like when Toronto police clashed with protesters yesterday. And Toronto Mayor John Tory, you know, the mayor of the city, responsible for the police force, responsible for quote unquote green lighting this action, he joined the morning rush on News Talk 1010 and discussed the protesters showing up. Here's what he had to say.
You know, I think as the police themselves said, they come to have a confrontation with the police. And so I regret that part of it very much, because we do so much work before we get to the stage of clearing the encampment to visit the people over and over again, the people experiencing homelessness, to try to convince them to take indoor housing. And many of them do. We've rehoused 1,700 people since the beginning of the pandemic from encampments into hotels and shelters and other places.
He says encampments themselves are unsafe. He continued.
These places are unsafe. They're unhealthy. They're illegal. We've had 130 encampment fires so far this year. We've had 283 visits by emergency services to this one place, Lamport Stadium, today Lamport Park. And we just can't, you know, let it go indefinitely.
He also said that he wishes yesterday went differently.
I just wish that all of this happened in a manner that was different. But we have a responsibility to the people experiencing homelessness and to the communities that surround those parks. And we have a responsibility to keep everybody safe. So when the 200 protesters show up, of course, there are going to be police there to protect the homeless people, to protect the protesters, to protect the journalists.
So here's the thing. There's parts of what John Tory says there that I agree with. That the encampments are perhaps not the most safe space, that police are there to protect, that he wishes a confrontation went differently and it didn't go down the path that he wanted it to. All fine. But here's the issue. At the end of the day, what the city is doing is they're creating a spin cycle. They're creating a cycle where these individuals who are in these encampments, who, by the way, many of them don't want to leave because of the bursting at the seams shelters, the widespread nature of COVID at the shelters. But what the city's ultimately doing is enforcing a camp, which will set up a new camp, which will set up more enforcement. And that's not leadership at the end of the day. You know, leadership, especially if you're the mayor of the city, if you're the provincial government or the federal government, is looking at the root causes here. Seeing why we have 235,000 homeless people in this country every single year, 35,000 any given night. And that's been made worse by the pandemic. And so this is not just bad politics. This is not just unfortunate or bad policing. This is not just the wrong strategy for the city of Toronto. But this is also an opportunity to lead and a failure in leadership. Because passing the buck isn't leadership. Allowing these encampments to form somewhere else and knowing that fully isn't leadership. This is where governments and housing can come in. This is where governments and policy can come in. This is where governments and the areas of responsibility of understanding the power that they have to correct these can come in. The pandemic's taught us anything. It's the interconnectedness, the value of community, the value of preparing, the value of working together. That's why on the other side of the break, I want to talk to a doctor who's going to talk to me about this other pandemic staring us right in the face. Zane Velji filling in for Evan Solomon.
The The Evan Solomon Show continues with special guest host Zane Velji on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hey, Canada, just before the break, I was telling you about my, you know, personal values around housing, how over the last year or so, I've gotten involved more in the advocacy related to housing, how it's opened my eyes to being so fundamental to so many of the human rights issues that we struggle with today. And yesterday in Toronto, we saw that 26 people were arrested at Toronto's Lamport Stadium Park, where the city and the police forcibly evicted those living in encampments. Here's what that sounded like if you missed it. Here's what it sounded like yesterday in Toronto when police clashed with these protesters. And you might be asking yourself, why did this happen, right? Why, on both sides, why are the individuals in these encampments refusing to leave? Why are they not wanting to seek shelter in a shelter or another form of temporary accommodation? And why, on a political and policy level, were the police greenlit to be so assertive? And let me be clear, this is not just a Toronto story. Now, I sit here in Calgary. This is a story, you know, in many ways of several things triangulating: health, human rights, housing, political leadership. And to join me in the conversation, I want to bring in Dr. Nahid Dusani. He's a palliative care physician and health justice advocate. He's one of the most articulate and passionate voices on this. Oh, Dr. Dusani, how are you doing? And thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me on, Zane. Really appreciate it.
Listen, you know, and I call you Dr. Dusani. I know you well. So I'm going to use the first name, not as a sign of disrespect, but as a sign of being able to do what we do here, which is talk openly and honestly. And one of the things you've talked openly and honestly about, if I can say, is drawing that relationship between health and housing, between social justice, health, and housing, if I can say. And so before we get into the specifics, do you mind just jumping in and kind of giving our listeners an understanding from your perspective, that intertwined relationship between those three things?
Absolutely. And first of all, you can call me by my first name anytime. We're all friends. I will say that, you know, it's important for listeners to recognize that people experiencing homelessness in Canada are arguably Canada's sickest subpopulation. This is a population that's 28 times more likely to have hepatitis C, 5 times more likely to have heart disease, 4 times more likely to have cancer. Mental health rates are higher as well. And actually, the average life expectancy for people who experience homelessness in this country ranges between 34 and 47 years old. They die at a rate that's 2.3 to 4 times higher than you and I. So we're talking about people who are very sick at baseline from physical and mental health and live every day on the edge where they're at risk of their life ending.
And that's super helpful as we talk about this story in Toronto, which kind of begs a question for me. You know, I hope we can collectively agree that these encampments are perhaps not the safest places for folks to live, especially with COVID still raging, despite what some of our politicians and political leaders across the country may want us to think. COVID is still very much here. So in your perspective, from what you see as being a physician on the ground there, why are people not leaving or refusing to leave these encampments?
Yes, I think sometimes arguments around this really focus on, well, the city, you know, did XYZ to provide supports. And what you really have to do is dig deep into what those supports look like. On a daily basis, in a city like Toronto, it is actually very difficult to get individual accommodations during a pandemic that are safe. Also, at a system-wide level, the capacity really is not there to support people in these settings. You can get access to congregate settings indoors, but as we know, COVID is likely an airborne disease. And so what that means is that people are being put at risk. We also have to start believing lived experiences on the ground. The people I care for who live in encampment communities tell me it is not safe to go into these spaces. And therefore, I do not want to go into these spaces. I feel safer living in a park than living in the place that the city is handing to me. That says a lot about the conditions that are needed to support people and the fact that we need to start investing in high quality and affordable housing to solve this issue.
Yeah, you know, I'll get to the housing in a second, but you brought something up there that kind of tweaked a thought, which was in the past, and I believe in the very recent past, you've kind of called this, if I can paraphrase, a criminalization of poverty. What do you mean by that?
Across the board, whether it's tickets for panhandling or the vivid, violent, graphic scenes we saw yesterday at Lamport Stadium and have seen at Alexander Park and Trinity Bellwoods, this is the criminalization of poverty. We now have three incidents where the city of Toronto has created paramilitary operations, sent hundreds of police, plainclothes officers, horses, surveillance vans, facial recognition technology, and drones just to remove, you know, a set number of people, about 60 or so people from these three parks. What we're seeing as a growing trend is the growing criminalization of poverty. Poverty is the result of the decay in social supports for people around physical health, around housing, around social assistance at the regional, city, provincial, and national levels. And if any one of us could actually become homeless at any time. And what we do instead of supporting people is we further criminalize them and target and attack them. And this is what the criminalization of poverty looks like.
You know, the numbers are staggering, right? Like the 235,000 homeless in a year, the 35,000 any given nights. But you bringing up this point about the paramilitary style operation, you know, my jam is, unlike you, as much as my parents hate it, I'm not a doctor. I don't look at this through. By the way, would it matter? Because I'd call you, someone would probably call me by my first name on a radio show anyways. But, you know, I'm not a doctor. I view this through the political lens. And from the political lens, this makes no sense whatsoever, right? Like you look at this and the images and the audio clip I played just before teeing you into the conversation, that doesn't help. That doesn't help from a visual perspective. It doesn't help from a sort of a political traction perspective. Also, from a policy sense, it makes zero sense because we're then having, as we know, as we have seen, it does not take a large amount of mental gymnastics to understand that this will lead to another encampment, that people will kind of protest and house and find other ways to make their point through another encampment. So even the costs financially that a city has burdened to make this happen, to get these poor, you know, sort of PR outcomes, these poor policy outcomes, is going to just lead to more and more of this, while that could be investment, time, resources, capacity placed into something bigger, grander, and perhaps, more solutions focused like housing, as you were mentioning.
Absolutely. You know, when it comes to political strategy and thinking around that, I often listen and tune into you, Zane. But now that I'm actually on the call with you, I will reflect on the fact that I often think about the fact that it's not clear to me what the political strategy is from a public relations and communications perspective from the City of Toronto, from the mayor, from councillors that have gone on to support this. This is an international scandal. The world is watching the City of Toronto and seeing how the City of Toronto is treating those who are most oppressed, those who are most marginalized and vulnerable, and saying, what are you doing? The other piece is it's hard not to think about the cost of, you know, the police officers, the vehicles, the technology, the operations, the hours behind it, like the planning behind it. If we had just invested that into housing, what would be possible? I think yesterday's events also bring up the time-old issue that we need to continue to talk about, is the fact that we need to reflect on whether, you know, we really want to be investing in policing moving forward. You know, yesterday's events are a great, affirmation that we really need to, you know, think about defunding the police and reallocating those funds to housing, social, and health programs for our communities.
I appreciate it. Dr. Nai Dasani, palliative care physician and health justice advocate. Thanks, my friend. On the other side of the break, I'm going to be talking about the most bizarre story in Canadian politics. Yes, I'm officially declaring it that this is Zane Velji filling in for Evan Solomon on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show, today with special guest host Zane Velji.
So they say at some point that you need to just stop selling, that when the client just says yes or they agree, that it's over, that the deal is done. You need to stop selling and you need to start closing. That's good business advice. I might even say it's good political advice if you're the Green Party, because I agree. Stop selling me, Green Party. You have already sold me. You have sold me as the most bizarre story in the last half decade in politics. I can't think of anything like this. To remind you, the Green Party has been at war with their leader, Annamie Paul. What is that included? Well, let me give you the bevy of things that's included. It's included a review of her leadership, not through any official protocol, but just saying, we don't like you, you need to go, airing that out in public. It's included removing her staffers, the two people responsible for scheduling the leader of the Green Party, to provide comments to, the climate in the middle of a climate emergency in this country. They're gone. It's starving her of funding for her riding campaign so she can try to be successful and gain a seat in the House of Commons in Toronto Centre. That's gone. Oh, they've also wanted to revoke her membership. You know that $10 piece of paper that you can purchase for any political party that you and I, by the time this segment is over, you can go in and become a member of any political party in 10 minutes. They want to review hers. Unprecedented. Then they wanted to hold a vote of non-confidence, which is a fancy way of saying, we don't believe in you, you got to pack your bags. And last week, it seemed like she finally got a win, Annamie Paul, that is, that this vote was set aside. She did a press conference in Toronto, talked about how hard of a time this has been for her, how she'll keep persevering, how she'll still want to ensure that she can get as many Green Party seats, including her own. And then yesterday, we find out that vote of non-confidence was only canned because of arbitration, which was pushed for by the leader herself, Annamie Paul. And now the party wants to fight her over that in open court. I'm going to bring Stephen Carter in, my podcast colleague, campaign strategist, president of Decide Campaigns. Stephen, I have to ask you straight up. First of all, do you agree with me that this is perhaps the most bizarre story in Canadian politics you've seen in the last half decade?
I think that this is insane. I mean, if there's going to be an election in the coming weeks, we know that. Everybody knows that. The Green Party seems to be more intent on destroying themselves at this particular moment in time than any other political party in the history of political parties in Canada.
Well, can we even call them a political party at this point? Like, you know, they have showing zero scruples in terms of wanting to be that over the last 6 months.
Well, no, I mean, they're clinging to some sort of set of rules that aren't the rules in politics. So I think you're right, Zane. This isn't a political piece. This is people who didn't like who got elected leader trying to take her out because they're now saying that her leadership style doesn't match with theirs. They should resign. If you're the Green Party president, you should resign. If you're a candidate for the Green Party and you can't support this leader, you should resign. If you're a riding president, you don't support this leader, you should resign. That is the model that democracy demands. Democracy elected Annamie Paul, not you. Get out of the way and let her lead. And if she takes it the wrong direction, then she takes it the wrong direction. But if she takes it the right direction and the opportunity is realized of a country that is looking at a climate emergency, as you said, grabs onto the Green Party and says, now is your time, then she can realize that. Right now, she can't realize anything because you, Green Party executives, are destroying your own party, destroying it.
Let me talk about their electoral chances in a second, but let's go down this pathway for a moment here, right? So a lot of this, in fact, I should say almost all of it, has been either aired out in the public through the press and the media, or has been very easily investigated and found out to make it a public story. If you are a part of the Green Party and you're saying, you're listening to yourself, Stephen, and you're saying, listen, you know, many of the sins of Annamie Paul, you do not know, one Stephen Carter. Many of the sins and the victimhood that she's painting herself is false. So yeah, you might be saying she was elected through a quote unquote democratic process within the party. But if I feel like this is the wrong direction, Shouldn't I stand up against it? Shouldn't I fight against it? You've said yourself that there's an election coming up. What would you say to someone who's perhaps articulating that in closed rooms or closed circles, or is thinking that if they're part of the Green Party today?
Don't be so stupid, is what I would say to them. Let's assume that every one of her supposed sins is correct. Everything that she has done that has been reported is actually true. It doesn't matter. Get out of the way. She's the leader. This is what happens in politics. The leader is the party. And we can decry that. We can say, well, that's not the way it's supposed to be. Parties are supposed to be about ideas and ideals and, you know, and asking the people to buy in. And it should be larger than one person. Yeah, would that it was. Would that it was. This is not our reality. Our reality is that the party becomes identified with the leader, and now the party chose this leader. Everything that they are doing undermines the members that selected the leader herself. If every sin that she is accused of is true, doesn't matter. They should be supporting the leader. This is the way that politics works. And if you can't be in politics, then get the hell out of politics, because it's embarrassing for me watching you be this bad.
Yeah. And so, Carter, extend this for me. Talk to me about what this means on their electoral chances. You queued it up a bit, but you think they're done here? You think that the Green Party, because of this public implosion, which, by the way, has been a drip campaign over months. If all of this had happened in a 2-week or 1-week cycle, I think we could have forgiven them. But this has been, what, months now that we've been tracking this bouncing ball that, you know, I come back on this show or on our podcast, we kind of throw this thing up again. Do you think that because of the elongated timeline and, frankly, just the unprecedented nature of how bizarre this is, that they're screwing their electoral chances in a major way, and perhaps even the future of the party as it exists as we know it today in a significant manner?
I think the public knowledge of this became around the flare-up around Palestine and Israel.
Yeah.
And, you know, one could argue, not even a core issue for the Green Party. That's not, I mean, sure, it's an important issue, but it's not a core issue. It's not what people vote on. What's your position on Palestine? So when you have that type of a flare-up, and then you continue to light yourself on fire at every opportunity from that moment on, you lose an MP. You've got your former leader offering no support to the current leader. And if that anybody,
oh, yeah, you know, I'm going to jump in there. Can I ask you about that statement that Elizabeth May put out, that statement / non-statement? You know, she puts it out, well, I don't know, like 7 weeks into this drama. And she pretty much says, I'm a member of the Green Party and support the Green Party. Annamie Paul is the leader of the Green Party. I'm paraphrasing, but that was effectively the spirit.
Yeah, I mean, it was like too little, too late, with no commitment at all. Elizabeth May, I would argue, is probably one of the reasons that this situation continues the way it is, because she remains de facto leader of this organization. She should have allowed the space for Annamie Paul to come in and actually be the leader. And instead, Elizabeth May, who I've criticized many times for making the Green Party more about her than about actual issues, continues to be one of the worst things that's ever happened to the Green Party. The Green Party should have taken off by now. It should have been a major party in Canada at a time when we are dealing with significant climate emergencies. But instead, the Green Party has just allowed themselves to be co-opted and taken over by the NDP, the Liberal Party, the Black Quebecois, all of whom have robust climate policy and are occupying the space that the Green Party wants to be in.
I knew you'd come in hot. Thanks, Stephen. I appreciate this.
No worries. Have fun.
Stephen Carter, campaign strategist and president of Decide Campaigns. I love having Stephen on. Always gives it to me straight. Always gives it to me with a little extra mustard on it. On the other side of the break, I want to keep it on politics. I want to talk about the most important political ingredient, what I call the L word. Yes, indeed, the L word. Which leader seems to have this L word in spades? There's one of them. And I want you to know that he might make a big difference in this next election. I'll tell you on the other side. This is Zane Velji filling in for Evan Solomon on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
The Evan Solomon Show continues with special guest host Zane Velji on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
What's going on, Canada? Back here with you. Hope you're doing well. Hope you're kind of having a good Thursday. I always love my chats with Stephen Carter, campaign strategist, political commentator, general loudmouth, generally hot takes, but I really agree with his take on the Green Party. I feel like if you are right now opposing Annamie Paul, you got to leave. You have to leave. Yeah, you might not think she's capable. Yeah, you might not think she's the right leader for the party. Yeah, you might not think she's the person you want carrying the baton for an upcoming election. You may have buyer's remorse. You may feel like things are not necessarily going your way. But you got to leave. It just has to be that way. And speaking of political party leaders, here's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about what I call the L word in politics. The big L word that I have is likability. The L word that I think so many of us often forget that we're voting for. The fact is that for many of us, likability is the core question that we're voting on, that we're thinking of. Yeah, it might be the color of the jersey that a political party puts on. Yeah, it might be the policies that a political party has. But when it comes down to it, the likability of a leader is where things really matter for voters. And I want to get your take on this. I'll give you my take on a second in terms of which leader has the likability bump or could make a huge impact with likability. But give me a call, 1-855-633-1010, or text me at 71010. Where does likability fit on the spectrum of things that you are going to be voting for this election? The likability of the leader. It's that old quote, the quote around George Bush. Yeah, he may not have been the smartest. Yeah, he may not have been the brightest. Yeah, I'm not sure I even necessarily agreed with his policies or his politics. But I'd love to get a beer with him. I'd love to get a drink with him. I'd love to be able to sit down with him at some point. Where is likability going to be for you this coming election? Give me a call, 1-855-633-1010, or text me at 71010. There's one leader in this country that's actually getting a huge bump on likability. That's getting a huge bump on his ability to lead. In fact, that leader, Jagmeet Singh, leader of the NDP, is outpacing Aaron O'Toole in likability and potential to lead. And that might have massive ramifications and massive impacts for us as we head into this election. As we head into this election anytime this summer, coming to us in as soon as August, likability for Jagmeet Singh could put him over the top in three-way races, could put him over the top in certain areas in Ontario. The fact is he's engaging in a way that no other leader is. He meets that test for many in terms of wanting to sit down, perhaps being authentic to who he is. Some of you may not like it. You may find it smarmy. You might find it, you know, what is he trying to do, campaigning on TikTok? But here's one thing you can say, that it's not authentically him, that he's not likable, that he doesn't have a sense of charisma and charm, that is not engineered, but is generally his. How big is likability for you this coming election? Robin, what's your take?
Oh, man, hi. I actually think it's an indictment of our system that it comes down to likability because we can't even trust politicians on policy anymore. So I just think that it's ridiculous. You know, it's not about issues.
And Corbin, for you, if I can keep you on the line, are you voting on policy and policy alone? Is that going to be what decides it for you this election?
I select on policy. On the last elections, I did not want Trudeau to get a majority because he's not trustworthy, and I, as a matter of fact, voted another party just to try to minimize his vote, but I wanted him to have a minority government. I will be the same thing again this year. This election.
I appreciate that, Corbin. Ryan, what are you thinking, Ryan?
It's always been a major factor in the past, but I'd have to say that this time around, it's a non-issue to me. I don't find anybody very likable other than, as you mentioned, Jagmeet, but that's where I have an issue with policy. So really, I think I'm going to have to do a bit of a deep dive into policy.
Ryan, if I can stick with me for a second. You said it was an indicator or a decider for you in the past. Can you tell me for which election and for who was it kind of a decider for in terms of a political party leader that likability mattered to you?
Well, I'd have to say that perhaps it was more the fact that there was a previous leader who I did not like, and therefore, you know, he was already kind of, a minus one or two, and therefore the opposition became much more likable. I would say that often as a tiebreaker, it is definitely somebody that you can relate to. But I would say in this instance, it's just unfortunately the current previously likable leader has shown to be, let's say, less confident than, overcomes likability.
No, I love that take. Thanks, Ryan. Thanks for, and appreciate you kind of walking me through your thinking there. 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. Around likability, how big of a factor is that going to be for you in this coming election? Ryan makes an excellent point here. You know, often likability is the clincher. It's not the baseline. It's not the first thing. It kind of puts it over the top. And I think for many folks, Jack Layton was that person. Jack Layton had the right policies for many. He had the authentic sort of charisma. He was been around for so long, but it was just that no one really disliked Jack Layton. Even when they tried to attack him, it was difficult. Even when they tried to go after him, it was really, really tough. And so likability was really the clincher over the top. On the other side, we're going to talk about the monstrosity in Gatineau. Zane Belger pulling in for Evan Sullivan.
You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show, today with special guest host, Zane Velji.
Hey, what's going on, Canada? Zane Velji back here with you.
This last segment.
So just coming back here, chatting with you about all things going on. I've got a story I want to walk you through in a second. It has everything. It has NIMBYism. It's got a mansion that didn't meet zoning bylaws. It's got a 51-page judge's decision, which is instituting a reversal. It's amazing. It has everything you want, frankly, everything you need in a modern neighborhood battle. It has all of it. And I'm so excited to walk you through it. But before that, I missed some texts earlier on the story of likability, and I got some really interesting texts that I want to go to on this story of where is likability sitting with
action?
How big is likability going to be?
How big of an issue is
for you in this upcoming election? And in getting a text here saying, Zane, likability is more of a subconscious motivator. And even cases where it's conscious, people, when asked about it, would not be honest about it in their decision. That's David from Markham. I agree, David. I think for many people, as we had a listener last segment say, it's that thing that puts it over the top. It's that item that seals it, that clinches it for you. May not be the core, but it's the one that kind of puts it over the top. And for some people, it starts there. Likeability opens up a conversation to say, you know, I should consider this person. I kind of like them. What are they about? And I feel like that will matter this election. As we have an election that ironically might be about nothing. You know, as big of a deal as it is in terms of all the things it could be about, it might actually not find a focal point. And when we know when elections don't find a focal point or a core issue to rally against, it becomes about personalities. It becomes about brand. It becomes about someone's ability to translate, to relate, to be one of the people. That George Bush test that I mentioned earlier, to be someone that you can sit with and have a drink and have a conversation, that they don't speak above you, that they're at eye level, so to speak. I'll read one more text before I move it on to the story I want to talk about here. My first vote was for Pierre Trudeau, and it was because I was young and I loved how rude and confident he was. Charisma. But I worked in the oil field, and by 81, I lost my new home, my job, my young wife, and left the country to find work. So I'm looking for policy this time around. Really interesting text, right? Likeability kind of captured, or charisma got someone into the fold, but it's policy in their later years that's now making them think differently, decide differently, reprioritize the factors that are part of the mix. Okay, let me move it to Gatineau, because I want your reaction to this. But before I get your reaction to this, and before I give you the number again, I need to break down this story. So there's this multi-million dollar home in Gatineau. And yesterday, a judge in a 51-page ruling indicated that this multi-million dollar house had to be taken down. So it's built. It's been built there for about 6-7 years now. So it's not like this house that's under construction, you know, that doesn't have its siding or doesn't have its roofing just yet needs to go. No. It's here. It's been around. It now needs to be torn down. Well, you might be asking why. Well, the reason is that in 2013, when the house got its zoning was 7 meters away from the street. You might be saying, Zane, why does that matter? Well, a standard development permit needs a zoning of 15 meters. Okay. And nearby residents said, no, this can't happen. This is 15 meters. But the builder and the homeowner at that point said, well, we've actually got this approved. This has all been approved by zoning. But the neighbors were loud enough, persistent enough, frankly, didn't like the monstrosity that was this home. The other added element here is that this mansion, stealing something that Hannah told me this morning, looks like a mansion amongst a set of dollhouses where it just towers over the other homes. It's kind of an eyesore. It doesn't really fit in. So these neighbors said, well, that's not good enough. And city council responded and said, you know, we're going to make a one-time exemption for this home to say we made a mistake out of human error to allow this home to be built 7 meters rather than the standard 15 away from the road. But you know what? We'll let it slide. We'll give it an exemption. But you and I both know what persistent neighbors can do. Well, they can delay something for several years until a judge finally ruled yesterday that the house indeed, reversing the decision of city council, by the way, that the house indeed is too close to the road and needs to be taken down. Here's neighbor Mike Beard's reaction to the judge's decision.
Nobody was happy when it was being built. So if it's coming down, then I would think there's a few people here that are a little more than happy.
And here's another neighbor reacting to the situation as well.
I understand the frustration when this was built, but after so long, I also feel bad for the owner. So I think everybody loses at the end. The taxpayers will pay for this.
This story is not over, but this story is bizarre. Yeah, okay, 7 meters versus 15. Sure, one-time exemption. They think they're in the clear. No, they're not. Persistent neighbors, a court filing, and a 51-page judge's decision now reversing it. And of course, the costs here are insane. The homeowner is now suing the city for $3.6 million. The legal costs are being picked up by the city for this particular situation. Are people jealous here? Is this wrong? I want to get your take. This is where you come in. Should the mansion have to be torn down? I think this is crazy. I mean, people need to find something better to do with their time. Let's start there. But should the mansion have to be torn down? 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. Let's be honest. How many of us have actually not walked down our neighborhood and looked at a home and say, I hate that house. I can't believe someone lives in there. Or I can't believe someone decided to make that custom house building decision. Or goodness, that's an eyesore. Or that blocks a view. Seriously? Seriously? That's what people wanted to spend their time on? 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. Are they really upset that it's too close to the street or it doesn't fit their neighborhood? We can really see what's going on. Yup. That's what I see this as. How many times have you gone down the street and tried to be like, well, you know what? This house is an eyesore. Not because of how it's built or how big it is, but how close to the street it is. That has been said a grand total of 0 times. Have you ever strolled down with your significant other and your family on a neighborhood walk and been like, you know what? I think I want to spend the next 8 years of my life fighting the fact that this house is too close to the sidewalk. Yeah, that's going to be what I do. I'm getting another text here. The judge's decision will be overturned as the municipality passed an exemption, which was wrongly overruled. It will be struck down. I think it might be too. I'm going to keep on this topic. I find this topic to be so bizarre, so ridiculous. I want more of your calls. 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. If you're on the line, keep holding. I'm going to get you on the other side. Should the mansion have to be torn down? Your calls and texts continue next. This is Zane Velji filling in for Evan Solomon on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
The Evan Solomon Show continues with special guest host Zane Velji on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
I love hate this story, by the way. If you're just joining us, we're talking about a mansion in Gatineau. I'll give you the quick deets if you're just catching up. A mansion in Gatineau that in 2013, by human error, got a zoning approval that let it be built 7 meters away from the street. Now, the classical or the traditional requirement is 15 meters. City Council, knowing that they made a human error, granted them a special exemption, said, okay, fine. We made a mistake, human error, go ahead, live your life. But there's nothing that a group of persistent neighbors can't do because some 8/7 years later, a judge, as of yesterday, has overturned it and ordered that this house be torn down, that this $3 million mansion be torn down. My question to you, should the mansion have to be torn down? 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. I'm getting so many texts and calls, but David, I'm going to you first. What do you think?
Well, I'm telling you, this is a symptom of our culture, the soft underbelly of a culture that is completely safe, is completely without threat, and completely taken care of. The woke narrative is we have to find a boogeyman because there is not one. And could you imagine not having purpose in your life that you would have to be woke enough to go after this house? I mean, really, you need purpose or you need a threat because this society has become soft and it's become pathetic. And by the way, I agree with the text that came in before the break. It'll be overturned in a minute. As soon as city council signed off on it, it was going to stay.
Yeah, thanks for your call, David. I appreciate it. I mean, David kind of encapsulates my feeling. Despite my, and if you've been hearing me for this week, you probably know I've got some left of center viewpoints. This just doesn't make sense to me. Like, where are you putting your commitments? How many of us have been on a walk in our own neighborhoods and been like, I don't like that house, but what am I going to do? Spend my time fighting it? For some people, the answer might be yes. Ken, you say, don't tear it down. Tell me why.
I don't think it should be torn down. I think, like, it's a waste of money for the city. It's a waste of money for everybody. We have way better places to spend the money, that's for sure. I would have one question. I'd be curious to know, was it actually built before they discovered that this was wrong? Or did it happen, they discovered it after the fact? Because if it wasn't built, I kind of don't like the fact that the guy just barged through and said, well, I got an exemption from city council and let it go anyway. Because I don't necessarily agree with that, and I could see that happening as well. If it was built and they discovered it after the fact, then what a waste of time and money for everybody. Can we not find somewhere better to spend their money? This is nuts.
Yeah, I appreciate the call, Ken. I really do. It's a good distinction, right? The timeline here, because it's so long, that's what makes this even more ridiculous to me. That you've been fighting this for so long, and now you're adding another chapter, as many of the calls and texts I'm getting right now say, which is, by the way, this will be overturned. He got the permits in 2013. Council granted him the exemption in 2014. Right? So in 2013 is where they said, yeah, go ahead, do your thing, build your house. And then in 2014, he did it and got the exemption from council after they realized they made a quote-unquote human error. I got another David on the line. David, what are you thinking? What is your take on the mansion in Gatineau?
Well, if they don't overturn it on appeal, I think what the city needs to do is they need to take that section of road that's in front of that house, rip it up, throw some grass in, put a driveway in, and turn that one street now into two dead ends and bring that house into compliance with the bylaw. That way they don't have to tear it down. To tear it down is a waste of resources. It's a waste of emissions. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of money that eventually the taxpayers are going to have to burden. So, you know, get creative. Rip that road up. Make it two dead ends now and throw a driveway through a new patch of grass and you have the house in compliance with the bylaw.
Yeah, I appreciate the take, David. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I agree with folks that this will get overturned, that eventually, you know, this will simmer, that logic and common sense will find itself into the conversation. Frankly, I commend city council back in 2014 saying, oh, we screwed up, but what are we going to ask you to do? Change it? No, you get the exemption. But the advocacy here has extended this, has cost the city already millions of dollars. Add on top of that a lawsuit by the homeowner, who, by the way, is not commenting, probably rightfully so, as they wait for appeal, who's now suing the city for several million dollars. Let me get some texts here before I go back to the phones. The neighbors are a-holes. I don't know who you are, sir or madam, or person. I feel like you might be speaking on behalf of a few people. Getting a different texter, yes, tear it down. I have the same issue in Newmarket at a $4 million home that was built amongst bungalows and semis. It looks bad. It doesn't fit the style of the city or the neighborhood. City officials need to make better city planning decisions and sort this out better. That's from Eric. So, Eric, here's the thing. I agree, but I disagree. Sure, it doesn't fit the aesthetic. I think that much is clear. But is that a reason to tear down a home? You have yourself to inject into the process before, but this is a home that's been half a decade plus. I mean, aesthetics is one thing. This is a mistake that was made by the city. They owned up to it. This person's built their home, living their life, and now they're told to tear it down. Eli, I have you on the line. What are you thinking?
Hey, I have so many points to make. I'm not sure where to start, but let's start with aesthetics. So if they're going to use, you know, their argument is about aesthetics, then why don't they go pick out some ugly homes all over the city? And there's a ton. There's so many ugly homes that can be torn down. And then why don't they go rally against that? Like, this is just so disgustingly insane and selfish. How much selfishness do these people, do these neighbors have to not care about how much money has gone into this, the planning, the architecture? And there's a family that lives there, assumingly, right? Like, you know, how selfish do you have to be to say, oh, yeah, just tear it down. I don't like the way it looks. Well, it's already there. It's already there. And, like, this is just a natural progression of the city becoming wealthier, right? Like, Ottawa, I live in Ottawa, and, you know, if you go back two or three decades, we didn't have these mansions. We didn't have these oversized mansions that we see today in Alta Vista. And, you know, I know someone who built a kind of a mansion, not really a mansion, but, you know, compared to his neighbor, it's kind of a mansion. And he's had nothing but, you know, arguing and nitpicking over every little thing that he's done just because he built a house in Alta Vista that is, you know, kind of twice the size of the other homes that are surrounding him. But this is just going on, right?
I appreciate it, Eli. I appreciate your take. Really good points. Really, really good points. Steve, I want to get to you quickly. I got 30 seconds. Lay it on me.
The city screwed up. They gave him the pass. They owned up to it. He built it. It's done. I mean, the neighbors, aesthetics is a completely subjective thing. I have a house across the street from me that looks like it's an audacious Greco-Roman. It's just absolutely horrendous. I just don't look at it. It's that simple. It doesn't.
Appreciate it, Steve. Thanks for your take. Steve's right. I think Steve capstones us correctly. I'm gonna declare a decision on this one. I mean, listen, this will probably be overturned, but this combination of expenditure to the city, time wasted, advocacy, you know, who knows what the sins of the homeowner actually are, but does it matter? They've built a monstrosity, you know, sure. Who doesn't have to live or I can find you if by the way, if we're going to Eli's point, if we're going to find a committee to find monstrosities across the country of homes, I'm sure we can do that. But that's not the point here. The point is the homeowner did everything right. They got approval. City council said, oops, our bad. Our bad. Here's your permit. Go build your home, live your life. And now, 7 years later, a judge saying, not going to happen. On the other side of the break, should a joke get you fired one day before you're done your job? Find out what I'm talking about. This is Zane Velji filling in for Evan Solomon on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show, today with special guest host Zane Velji.
Oh, I have to say, I love all of your takes. I just want to thank you for that last segment. That was a ton of fun. I mean, nothing to split. I shouldn't even say we were split. I think the majority of the calls and texts were in the same direction. Around the house in Gatineau. The mansion. I want to move on to another topic. You know, I teed you up before the break saying, what if you got fired for a joke from your job one day before you're supposed to conclude your said job? Well, that's what's happening, and drum roll, please, in Tokyo. Yes, in the Tokyo Olympics. This morning, the Tokyo Olympic Organizing Committee fired their director of the opening ceremonies today. And if you're wondering, Zane, when are the opening ceremonies? Tomorrow, for a joke that he made at a comedy show. Now, he's a comedian, so it wasn't just a random guy who directs opening ceremonies and then also, you know, made a joke. No, he was a comedian back in 1998. He got fired today for that joke, a day before his job ended, the opening ceremonies. Now, the joke that he made, because that's important, the joke that Kentaro Kobayashi, the name of this comedian, made was back in 1998. He was accused of using a joke about the Holocaust in his comedy act. And his comedy act included a series of of figurines and puppets that he was using. And he used the phrase, quote, "let's play Holocaust" with those puppets and those figurines. And so the surfacing of that clip and of the social media fervor and of the comments against it around anti-Semitism, which is real and true and alive, don't want to dismiss that at all, are what got him fired. A day before the biggest part of his job, but also a day before his job was done. His job was over. I want your take on this. 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. Should the director of the opening ceremonies, which are happening tomorrow, have been fired today for his past Holocaust joke? 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. A joke he made in 1998. Yes, about a topic that I will fully acknowledge. You know, you've heard my conversations on this show around anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and anti-Black and anti-Asian hate that's going on in this country. So a serious topic, no doubt, but a joke, a comedian. This was his job, to make light of things. He used figurines and puppets to make a joke about the Holocaust where he said, "let's play Holocaust" with those figurines and those puppets. Should he have been fired? Because he was today. 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. Should he have been fired one day before his job was done? Getting a text here saying the Holocaust is nothing to joke about. Another text coming in saying Holocaust jokes are never funny or acceptable. 1998 or 2021, doesn't matter. Yes, he should have been fired. Another text coming in here from you guys. How far back should we go when it comes to this most ridiculous thing? By the day, people will dig deeper as they have to try to find a little piece of dirt to bring someone down. It's ridiculous. Also getting another text here in support of the first two saying making light of the Holocaust is not funny. I presume this person agrees that this individual should have been fired. 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. You know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, they say. And for many people, so is humor, right? It's in the ears of the beholder. I don't think that's ever been used as a phrase, but it's accurate that for many people, you know, joking about the Holocaust, no big deal. They're fine. It's okay. You know, many people who themselves are Jewish, it's been okay. But for others, you know, even including this article, any person, no matter how creative, does not have the right to mock the victims of genocide. It's from a rabbi who is quoted this morning on the firing of the now former director of the opening ceremonies of the Tokyo 2020 Olympics. 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. Another text here saying it's the Kevin Hart thing all over again. That's going to need some unpacking. Kevin Hart was supposed to host the Oscars, long story short. He was supposed to host the Oscars. Previous comments that he made, disparaging comments that he made, as an attempt as a joke, I'd say, weren't very funny. And I have no idea how quote unquote, the Holocaust joke here that this comedian made was received back in the day. So, you know, I don't know if that matters to folks. But Kevin Hart lost his Oscars hosting gig for this very similar situation. Greg, I have you on the line. Greg, what's your take?
First of all, what was the joke? Was he denying it during this puppet show he was giving, or was he making a point how serious it was, and he was using some prop to get that point across? I don't know that information, but I'll tell you what. Something that happened in 98 that, see, what's going on with people? Back in times, in certain times, things were more accepted, right? And that was just the sort of the common, you know, flow of things that may not be accepted today. So are we going to go back on everybody's history? Because these people who are going after people all the time, right, am I still on the air?
You're still here, Greg. I can still hear you.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, okay, I'll just finish up. These people who are chasing down people to cancel them out, they better realize that 30 years from now or 20 years from now, somebody's coming after you because you're setting the stage here, okay? Like, who are these knucklehead people who sit there all day long, got nothing better to do, and look somebody's history up of what they said in a couple sentences or a prop show and pass judgment on people?
Thanks, Greg. I appreciate your take. I'm going to leave it there, but I got your points, and thank you for making them. Appreciate the call. In its fullness, by the way, I didn't cancel Greg's call during a segment on cancel culture, though the irony would have been hilarious to me. Hearing your point, Greg, let me break that down in two pieces, right? You're getting a lot of support on the text line here for the second half of your comment. How far back are we going? You know, support here, including really a joke from that long ago. That's ridiculous. That coming to us from Todd. Then cancel all comedians because all jokes are racism and viewed through that lens. William, I have a minute for you. William, on the other line, I've got a minute.
Don't throw stones in glass houses. In other words, we are all at some point in our lives have said something that we regret. How far back are you willing to go? And this guy was a comedian. If he wasn't a good comedian, he wouldn't have a job. He wouldn't have anyone listening to him. So you got to take it in context.
I appreciate the call. Thanks. Thanks, William. Getting a lot of texts on humor is very subjective. And that kind of goes to Greg's earlier point. What was the joke? Well, we don't know, really. What we know right now is that he used stick puppets and figurines and he used Let's Play Holocaust, but it was enough to trigger the protest. It was enough for the Olympic Committee to decide we don't need any of this. Getting another text here saying, hell no, if he had said this recently, then yes. But for something that long ago, nope. The converse point, yes, and I applaud the governing board on firing him. Even on the morning of the opening ceremony, I cannot accept that anyone would make light of this in the most atrocious periods in someone's lifetime. And you find yourself with tons of company on that point. On the other side of the break, sex. I was told that would work. Can blind dating and blind mating even happen in 2021? You'll hear my thoughts next. Zane Vilgery filling in for Evan Solomon.
You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show, today with special guest host Zane Velji.
Hey, what's going on, Canada? You know, there's so much to talk about on the TV front, but more and more, and by the way, I will make the plug again, mainly for producer Hannah, that the only thing to start with on the TV front is Ted Lasso, the best show on television, which has season 2 tomorrow. But there's so many things on the Netflix, the Crave, the Hulu, the Disney Plus front. But more and more of it is about dating. Reality shows about dating. And of course, we've had the classic Bachelor and Bachelorette, which have been going on for, oh goodness, 20-some years. The Dating Game back in the 60s. It's not like it's new to television, but the plethora of dating shows and mating shows is unprecedented. And there's one that Netflix has come out with that I just find to be bizarre. But before I jump into that, I want to talk about this broader story of dating and blind dating. Is it possible? Is it doable? I'm here for this final segment before we close out today, and I see you again next week to get your best and worst blind dating stories. If you have one queued up, if you have one top of mind, text it to me at 71010 or call me at 1-855-633-1010. Your best or worst blind dating stories. Ones that you that could be cringeworthy. Still PG. Family show. Happy to hear. Ones that ended in perfect harmony. Send it to me here. 1-855-633-1010. Or text me at 71010. Your best and worst blind dating stories. But let me tell you about this Netflix show while you queue up those stories. So Netflix is coming out with another blind dating show. They, of course, have a show called Love is Blind, their most popular one, where contestants don't get to see each other throughout the course of the reality show, that they're trying to build connection in all parts of what they're up to without being able to see each other's physical appearance, their bodies, etc. But now Netflix has come out with another show called Sexy Beasts. Great title, by the way. And you'll understand why it's a great title when I explain it to you. Because Sexy Beasts takes the bizarre absurdity of The Masked Singer and puts it into a dating show. It takes the absurdity of having several hours and several thousand dollars of prosthetics put on your face. Not just a mask that covers your face, but quite literally a prosthetic that you put on that makes you look like a beast. And then individuals are asked to go to a bar and enjoy drinks together in these absurd prosthetics. And what they're looking for is that while they can see each other from the neck down, the hope here is that psychology would kind of take over, that instinct would take over to say, you know, what do we find attractive around the way they speak, their eye contact, their ability to do these things. It's another giant experiment in dating. But can it work? And has blind dating worked for you, especially in this age? But I want to get your stories, your best and your worst blind dating stories. 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. Many psychologists, many of those that kind of study romance, that study mating, that study this particular world of how we come together, how we decide the right partner, how we find someone attractive, how we find someone worthy of courtship, say that while it's novel and it can work, it kind of butts against, you know, modern psychology and practices of how humans always find a way to tether physicality, physical attraction into the conversation, even if they say they may not be. 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. Your best and your worst PG show blind dating stories. Getting a text here. My most recent blind date led me to my current girlfriend, which is now about 2 years in and will be the partner in life. That's awesome. My 24-year-old son, another text coming in. My 24-year-old son met his girlfriend on an Apple Free app. Met finally, 6 months later engaged. Not blind, but fast. And you know, there is some merit to this in some way. Because we're in this weird sort of world right now where you kind of think we're in the opposite of the blind dating world. Which is, how could it actually be that we blind date, especially with the proliferation of apps, with the proliferation of social media? You know, we're not blind dating anymore as much as we are, let me figure out who this person is, what their Instagram profile looks like, who their friends are, how their punctuation and grammar is in their tweets, what are their hobbies, who are their family members, what level of education do they have, what awards have they won, how many LinkedIn references do they have, dating. Blind dating versus that kind of dating I just mentioned. But what's interesting about that is that in many ways, as more and more of us are starting to use texting as a primary dating source or a sort of conversation starter and continuer, it's less about the physicality of having that person in front of you, especially during this pandemic, as many would attest to. But it's more about what the conversation is like. It's more about someone's wit, their charisma, their ability to kind of translate offline and online, their ability to translate in different ways. It's a weird world where we're more physical than ever before. But perhaps the way a conversation continues or a kindling begins or the fire kind of starts might actually remove the physicality from it. Getting another text here, best blind date, ! I need to read the exclamation mark because you can't see it. But this person wants you to know, best blind date, ! My sister Yvonne set me up on a blind date because she didn't want me to go back to BC back in 89. And we've been happily married since 1995. Congratulations. Blind date at 58 years old. We got married a year later. We are so well suited. Second marriage for both of us. That's awesome. I don't know about you. I will probably, out of strict curiosity, be checking out Sexy Beasts on Netflix. Anyone who's willing to sacrifice that much time to put together prosthetics for a social experiment. Another text coming in as we wrap up. Blind date 15 years ago. Friends set us up. Now my wife and still hot. Scott from Ottawa. Congratulations, Scott. I'll be back again with you all on Monday, talking more about everything under the sun. Hope you have a great weekend. Stay tuned to the iHeartRadio Talk Network. This is Zane Belge filling in for Evan Solomon. Have a great weekend.